Greetings and welcome to the Believe Knicks podcast. Matthew Miranda, as always, joined by Stacey Patton. But this is an exciting podcast for us because this is our first Knick playoff preview podcast of all time. So mark the date, mark the time, keep your ticket stub. This one is historic, and because of the historic nature of this pod, we had to have a special guest who I will introduce in a second. Before that, today's antiquated ad read is as follows. BetOnline remains your number one source for all your college basketball betting this season. Get analysis of every play, prop, and point at BetOnline. You'll find the latest odds, bracket contests, team matchups, and game trends at BetOnline. Updated odds for everything from live games, the conference championships, right through to the Final Four and championship game. I can't imagine how updated the odds are, given that that's all finished, but this is the ad read. BetOnline is your college basketball headquarters this season, and presumably next. Head to the website today or use your mobile device to sign up and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Be sure to use the promo code BELIEVE, B-L-E-A-V, to receive your bonus. BetOnline.ag, where the game starts. And where the pod starts is introducing today's guest. Our guest is a self-proclaimed unfortunate obsessive of the Cleveland Cavaliers. You can find them on Twitter at Bray_NBA. And there is a Substack coming out soon also, so keep a lookout for that. For the first, but hopefully not last time, let us welcome to the pod, Braden Todd. Braden, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's a lovely day up here in Lower Michigan, so thanks for having me on.
Where in Lower Michigan are you?
I'm attending Spring Arbor University currently, so by close to Ann Arbor.
Yeah, I went to Ann Arbor, so that's pretty
cool.
Gotcha.
Sweet. Yeah.
Is Spring Arbor like a suburb of Ann Arbor?
It's about 45 minutes away, so okay. I don't know. Okay. I don't know what it is with arbors up here, but
there's a lot of trees in Michigan, in case. Yeah.
There is. Okay.
I can't laugh because I live in Rochester, and there's the east side of Rochester, but then there is a town called East Rochester that is miles and miles east of Rochester, so I don't know what some of our ancestors are doing with town names, but that's for them to deal with. We're still alive, and we're talking about the Knicks and the Cavaliers. First, Braden, I just want to ask my first question about a series that I think a lot of people are excited about. Often the 4-5 matchup, you're hoping that's a fair fight. This one seems to me like a pretty good one. I keep reading a lot from the national press, not necessarily the local Cleveland press, about it's the first time the Cavs have been to the playoffs since LeBron was there, and it's the first non-LeBron team since, I think, 1998. Do you get any kind of a sense of, is there a different feel or vibe or appreciation to Cavalier fans that this is a post-LeBron thing, or is that the national media picking up on a stat that maybe doesn't mean anything to the fans?
No, yeah, I think there is definitely something to that, for sure. I mean, for me personally, this is the first time the Cavs have made the playoffs without LeBron since I've been alive. Something different. I mean, there's a lot of a homegrown element to it with Darius Garland and Evan Mobley leading the charge, drafted both of those guys, Isaac Okoro as a starter. Then, you know, just bringing in Jarrett Allen and Donovan Mitchell. It's cool seeing the team together rather than just everybody hopping on LeBron's back for the ride. And yeah, just an element of unknown to what these Cavs are going to look like. So I think there's definitely excitement there.
Do I take that to mean that if the Cavs next year could replace Isaac Okoro with LeBron James, that you would be against it because you're tired of seeing them on his back?
So that's actually a controversial thing to talk about among Cavs fans.
Is it?
I'm pro LeBron coming back if that's on his agenda. There are a lot of Cavs fans who are pretty particular to this group, though, and would prefer to ride them out.
Is it more a preference for the current group, or is it something against LeBron in some sense?
Yeah, that's... There are some people who, you know, just have a little bit of an itch with LeBron with him leaving twice. I mean, then there's some people who just think he's past the age of wanting to be a complimentary piece alongside what the Cavs already have. So, you know, you got a lot of differing opinions there. more than you'd probably expect.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Kind of before we get into the matchups as well, there is a kind of philosophical thing, because I think when you talk about building a contender, and the Cavs very much seem to be, if not like they're on the cusp for sure, and like personally, I just think it's a matter of when does Evan Mobley become an MVP level player, like that to me. But Mitchell has played at that level this year, and they've played at I think Pythag actually says that they've outperformed their record. If you look at net ratings, they should probably play like a 57 win team. But it's very tough to deny that, you know, I don't know if they make the, or at least for Knicks fans, it made a lot more sense to us for Cleveland to make the Donovan Mitchell trade, because you have two guys on rookie deals. Did they extend Garland yet, or?
Sorry, I cut out for a second. I don't know if you got that, but yeah.
Yeah, they have two guys on rookie deals, right? Evan Mobley and Garland. Who are really talented, and they could afford to make a move like that. Whereas the Knicks were not in that position before this season. So I guess the question is, you know, on the one hand, it seems like there's a lot of homegrown talent. The Cavs have made smart moves. On the other hand, are the Cavs like another piece of evidence that like at some point you have to get lottery, or you have to like end up high in the lottery to like, it's tough to build a contender without that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say so. I think it's very important to have that, you know, that guy that you're willing to build around before you look into making your other all-in move to pair next to them. So yeah, with the Cavs early on in the rebuild, we were looking for that guy, you know, had Darius Garland, Colin Sexton, picked up Jared Allen, all solid young guys, but not quite that guy who you're confident in can take the leap to all NBA MVP level play. Yeah, you look at the Hawks, they got Trae Young, felt confident to add in DeJounte Murray. That's gone a little bit south, but you know, once you have that core in place and that one guy you're confident in, I think Evan Mobley, what he showed his rookie year, just, I mean, made the Cavs front office very confident in what they have going forward. Just a very special player on both ends of the floor.
Do you think they wouldn't have made the Mitchell trade if, like, let's say they did get Jalen Green, or if it was a player who hadn't shown that much as a rookie?
Yeah, I would say so. So yeah, you'd probably want to add like another key player if you end up with a lesser young player like Jalen Green or Jalen Suggs or a guy among that caliber,
or even a guy like Franz, right? Like, I mean, terrific player. Franz, Scotty Barnes, like that's a different, I think, level of prospect from Mobley, right? Who I think off the bat, I mean, he probably is deserving of at least first team all defense, if not the best player. And yeah, like what, he's 20 now, 21. So I think that's like, they have like, you know, I think that definitely makes sense. And yeah, I mean, it's tough to like conceive building a winner without that kind of lottery luck. You know, the Knicks haven't been fortunate. They got the third pick. They did get RJ Barrett. But a lot of it has had to be developing prospects later in the draft. But I think the missing piece, and perhaps the difference in this series, is that as good as Brunson and Randall have been, the Knicks don't have quite the, you know, that MVP level caliber player that Mitchell has played like for much of this season. But I think the question for the Knicks is like, they build a good team, and the top end talent is tough, and that's why even now, even at the end of this season, there's Knicks fans who are like, oh, you know, we gave up the pick for Josh Hart, we don't have a first round pick this draft, and maybe we should have tanked or something. But there is something to it in that, not, I'm not an advocate of tanking, but it does seem like getting that kind of a player either requires gutting your roster or, you know, having a very poor season. I did want to check in a little bit about the series, big playoff series, and we want to talk about some of the key matchups. So I'll start with this. How I think Knicks fans, I wouldn't say I'm confident. I did feel like Cleveland was the best matchup out of the top four seeds for us. And that's not a knock on Cleveland. I think it speaks to just how good the top three teams are. Milwaukee has Giannis and Drew, who are elite defenders at the same position as our two best offensive players. Boston, when healthy, might be the best team in the league. And Philadelphia Embiid, the Knicks haven't had a solution for him. And, you know, so given that, I think Knicks fans are cautiously optimistic. That's where I am. With Randall hurt, I'd probably still predict the Cavs winning, but I think I'm cautiously optimistic. But definitely want to gauge, you know, what's your temperature and maybe the temperature of Cavs fans going into the series.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely a fair opinion to have. Cavs, I'd say, are, you know, just probably a tier below the top three in the East. So yeah, I'd say the general opinion among Cavs fans is that they expect to come out of this series with the win, but acknowledging that it won't be easy, it'll be a tough fight. The Knicks won this year in those games for both sides. Yeah, Cavs fans acknowledge just that this Knicks team won't be an easy out. A lot of a deep team, youthful energy, and yeah, Randall and Brunson have been great this year.
And you know, when you're talking about matchups, right? I know it's tough to boil down a series like this, but maybe not even individual matchups, right? But like stylistic, you know, like I guess like what do you think it's going to come down to? You know, if you had to boil a few things they're going to be watching out for in this series.
Yeah, I'd say the two matchups I'm looking closest at is Randall, with how the Cavs guard Randall, and I mean also just like when he'll be available in this series. I saw something saying that he's hoping to be back for game one, but you never quite know with these things. So I know Randall's players among Randall's archetype have given the Cavs some trouble this season, especially when you got Mobley on him. The Cavs love to have Mobley roaming, over-helping to an extent. And, I mean, when you're able to kick the ball out to Randall on the perimeter, when he has space ahead of him, attacking a scrambled defense, I think that could prevent some problems for the Cavs this series, trying to contain him off of Brunson and Barrett drives. Then I'd say the other one I'm keeping an eye on is how the Knicks defend Garland. Darius is, he's an up and down player at times. There's some teams that have seemed to been able to pull out the stops on him. He struggles against guys with more size and quicker feet. He's not an overly athletic or bursty player, more quick twitch and highly skilled. So I'm assuming the Knicks will put Barrett on him. So just seeing how RJ is able to deal with him, navigating screens, defending him in the mid-range and whatnot, I think that'll be interesting to see how that unfolds.
Do you expect them to attack more on offense? Is that the matchup you think the Cavs will go after, like Garland on Barrett, putting Barrett in screens? Or do you think they maybe hunt Brunson with LeVert? Or, you know, will we see more Okoro just so that you can... I think that's a big trade-off, right? If you play Okoro, you can put him on Brunson. And that is, like, those are the kinds of defenders... I mean, Brunson scored on pretty much everyone, but Okoro is the kind of guy who can slow him down a little bit, or make him hit tougher shots. But the trade-off is then, you know, Brunson can hide on defense a little bit more on Okoro, and maybe not. Maybe that's a misconception. But if you put LeVert out there, there's nowhere really for Brunson to hide. So, I guess my questions are, do you expect, you know, RJ to be, you know, attacking RJ either by putting him in ball screens with Garland, you know, getting away to get Mitchell matched up to RJ? Do you expect that to be a focal point, or maybe more, you know, attacking wherever Brunson is?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think there is a little bit of an unknown with how the Cavs will go about this, with this, I mean, being the first time this group is together in the playoffs. Garland and Mobley, it's their first playoff series, so we're yet to see how they'll handle the playoff environment. And Bickerstaff, even also, he's only coached in one playoff series before. So it'll be interesting to see what adjustments they make in-game. I think heading into the series, we'll see a lot of Donovan Mitchell, not quite heliocentric offense, but we'll be giving the ball to him a lot. Garland is a really good off-ball player, which has really helped him mesh with Mitchell this year, just being active, running off screens off-ball. So I think we'll see a lot of toggling between those two. And yeah, as mentioned with Okoro, he's improved as a shooter this year, but he's still a guy that teams segue off of. They're okay with him shooting it. He doesn't like to shoot it a lot. So going to need him to confidently be able to put up 5-6 threes a game. We'll see what comes from that. Cavs that have experimented using him as a screener at times this year. So they could be using that to get Brunson onto Mitchell if Brunson is matched up on Okoro, which he probably will. Haven't had a lot of success with that. So Okoro's, I mean, he's only 6'5", doesn't have a lot of size, so he's pretty easy to just avoid as a screener. But yeah, I think they'll definitely try to do a bit of that.
And is he good at, you know, has he shown a lot in short roles? So if the Knicks were to like momentarily hedge and recover there, is that something that the Cavs have been pretty good at exploiting with, you know, Mitchell, or especially with Okoro? But I know Mobley is good at that, but right. You know, with Okoro as a screener, is that something he's pretty adept at? Or
I wouldn't say so. I mean, he's just a smaller target to get the ball to on the roll. If you're able to blitz the ball handler for a second, it's a pretty easy recover. And he's not a guy I'd be too confident taking a few dribbles in the middle of the floor. He's a really good passer, but he just isn't a very comfortable on-ball player. So I don't think we'll see a lot of that, to be honest.
Matt, I want to throw this question to you as well. What are some of the top two or three things that you're keeping an eye on? And then like the follow-up, and I'll throw this to both of you, is also like, if the Cavs win this series, how do you expect that to look like? And if the Knicks win this series, what will that look like? But first, Matt, what are the top couple of things you're keeping an eye out on in this series?
First, to your earlier question, Garland is extended through 28. As to your question now, and I was actually going to ask Brayden about this, I am extremely interested in what happens for the Cavaliers between LeVert or Okoro in this series. I feel that, and I talked to Stacey about this a little bit, maybe like a week ago, I think Okoro can be an enormous swing in the series, because if he is at all effective on offense, they can do some things defensively that I think would really help them, particularly, as you said, against Brunson. If Okoro is not shooting well, I assume we're going to see more of LeVert. And Caris LeVert, since he was a net, has been one of the most... I don't have a feel for him at all. You watch some night, and I'm sure you see that. I don't know if he's still like this, but there were nights you would see him play in Brooklyn, and like, this guy is an all-star. This guy is a future. He's a steal. More people are going to know his name. And the more I've watched his career progress, I don't know what he is. Like, he does a lot of things, but I don't know, especially on that team, I feel like... So what I'm getting to is, I know that Garland, even though it's his first playoff, and who knows how people respond, I am confident Darius Garland is not going to just, like, crap the bed. Like, I think he's going to score, and he's going to do things. We know what Donovan Mitchell does in the playoffs. Jared Allen's game, I think, is pretty playoff-proof. Like, he is... What he does translates... And Mobley is, I'm just, as much as I want the Knicks to win, I am excited as a fan of the game just to see, let's see what Evan Mobley does now on the big stage. I have, and with the Knicks, obviously they're my team, but like, I know what Mitchell Robinson will do. If Randall is healthy, I think I know what he'll do. Even if he's not, I know what Obi Toppin can do. I know what Grimes and Barrett and Brunson can do. I have no feel for that fifth Cavalier starter. And I'm curious, I was going to ask you this question, Brayden. If 2 weeks from now the Cavaliers are done and they've lost to the Knicks, is it more likely that... Okay, that's the wrong question. Are you more confident in what Okoro might do in the series, what LeVert might do in the series, or do you feel that they're both question marks kind of equally?
Yeah, that's a tough one. The Cavs have that small forward spot. It's just kind of been a revolving door all year. I mean, we started out the year some. I mean, Karis had the starting small forward position early on in the year, then moved him back to towards the bench later on, just trying to distribute the touches and ball handling possessions. And we saw some Dean Wade at starting small forward before he got hurt. Now, Okoro's taken the position and he's played well there. But yeah, it's still a question mark pretty much no matter who's occupying that. I'd say last year's play-in, actually, Okoro's minutes were severely limited just because the Cavs couldn't afford to have him out there offensively. And so I'm interested to see if Bickerstaff is as quick to pull the rope on him in this year's playoffs. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how that plays out. I think he's got more confidence to his game this year and more confident attacking off the catch, more confident letting it fly. But yeah, offensively, still a big question mark with no real answers to that. And yeah, as far as Karis's go, it's been quite the roller coaster season for him, which is kind of the story of his career. Mm-hmm. Luckily, not a lot of injury problems for him, which it's also been a thing with him. But yeah, a guy who really has Cavs Nation divided. There were a lot of trade rumors swirling for him earlier on. Been struggling to finish inside the arc this season. I think the lack of shooting on the Cavs has played a factor in that, you know, just playing with guys like Okoro, Mobley, Allen, just not a lot of space in there if you're not a high-level finisher. And so, yeah, Karis has really struggled at the rim. He struggled to get his mid-range going. I think he's one of the, like, bottom five mid-range shooters this year, which is normally an area where he's been able to lean on in the past. I'd say one thing he does do exceptionally well at, and he's found a lot of success doing for the Cavs, especially as of late, is just finding a way to get by his initial man. He's got a good first step, long strides. He can get by his man somewhat easily. And then, I mean, even if he's out of control getting into the rim, he does a good job at drawing in the big and dumping it off to either Mobley or Allen, whoever's there at the rim for an easy finish. He's been consistently producing like two or three of those easy looks for Mobley and Allen at the rim. So I think it'll be interesting to see if like quickly Hart, Barrett, if they can keep him out of the rim, they can force him into tough shots, because he can definitely be a swing player for the Cavs this series.
One of the nice characteristics of this Nick team, which I don't think I've seen possibly ever in my lifetime, is the number of players who impact the game on both ends of the floor. Not just the starters, but even if you go to the Nick bench, Emmanuel Quickley is brilliant defensively, does a lot of things on offense. Josh Hart, we know, does things on both ends. Even Isaiah Hartenstein, it doesn't always show up offensively in the numbers, but he is a factor on both ends. Trivia question, Braden Todd, who is the best two-way player on the Cleveland bench?
The Cleveland bench.
You can say none of the above, because everything I have read from Cavalier website sounds like, you mentioned Wade. He struggled with his shooting this year. We know that C.D. Osman can score. He struggled with his defense. Ricky Rubio hasn't looked the same. How do you feel about... I feel going into the series, the one thing that I'm looking at where maybe the Knicks have an edge, even though I don't know how Tom Thibodeau's minutes will go, is I think the Knicks have a better bench, but you've seen the Cavs much more than we have. Is this a weak spot? Is this an overrated concern? Is it, you know, one night the bench is great and one night they struggle? How do you feel going into this series about the Cleveland bench?
Yeah, I think you can confidently say the Knicks have the upper hand there. It's been an issue for the Cavs most of the season, just trying to find some sort of rhythm outside of the top four guys. To answer your first question, I'd say Karis LeVert probably does nab that honor as a top two-way player. Not a great defender, but he's definitely upped his game since coming to Cleveland. Bickerstaff tends to have that effect on guys, just getting them to buy in and sell out defensively. He's a bit awkward, doesn't have the best footwork, has long legs, can get caught up on screens. But, you know, he's active in the passing lanes. He shuffles his feet, tries his best. Then, you know, some games he can give you 20, some games he gives you 5 points on poor efficiency. So that's always a toss-up. But if Dean Wade was fully healthy, I'd say it's probably him. But he's been struggling since coming back from his shoulder injury.
It was very I thought he gave actually quickly a lot of problems the last time the Cavs and Knicks played. It seemed like they were very aggressive. They used weight on him a lot, but generally throwing bodies at quickly. I hadn't seen, like, I think he still ended up with a good statistical game and he bounced back in the second half. But I loved some of the looks that they were throwing at him. I didn't love him as a Knicks fan, but I thought they were very creative. And I hadn't, frankly, since quickly has come off the bench, that's one of the first times I've really seen it. It felt like they tailored some of their plan.
Oh, apparently Stacy is no longer interested in this conversation, and he has to, there he is. Hey,
there we go.
All right, we lost you for a moment.
Yeah. So I guess you know, in terms of, you know, last game, obviously the Knicks had a lot of offensive success. The Cavs, I think, finished with the top defensive rating in the league. You know, Jared Allen coming back is going to be big. Isaac Okoro coming back is going to be big. You know, what kind of defensive adjustments do you anticipate, whether it's on Brunson or, you know, pick and roll defense? Do you think they might trap more aggressively with Mobley? Do you think they might, and we might see more pressure looks or those kind of things? You know, how have they dealt typically with problems like the ones that the Knicks pose?
Yeah. So the Cavs are an interesting team defensively. You got the front court full of high-level defenders, Okoro, Mobley, Allen. Then the back court, you got Garland and Mitchell, who are iffy at best. The thing the Cavs do have going for them is that, I mean, they all compete, even Garland and Mitchell. They play hard, especially in the playoffs. We'll see them take another step up. I'm interested to see how Donovan Mitchell steps up. We've seen him play some high-level defense this season, probably the best since he's been in the league. So we knew in college coming into the NBA that he had the ability to be a high-level defender. Just haven't seen that consistently at all in Utah, but starting to see flashes of that again. As far as schemes go, Aaron Okoro will be on Brunson, and I'd say he's among the top point-of-attack defenders in the league. Just has developed into a very good guy at just bothering the ball handler, fighting through screens, staying close, not giving up anything easy. With Allen, I think we'll see a lot of drop coverage. They like to play him at the level and just kind of have him backpedal, trying to prevent the lob and the floater at the same time, just trying to play that in-between game. Then if we see Mobley get involved in pick and rolls, that's where things get interesting. They use Mobley in a lot of different ways. I think we'll see him switch a bit more. I think we saw that in the last matchup versus the Knicks. We saw Mobley get switched onto Brunson a lot, with Lamar Stevens being the point of attack defender. And yeah, some mixed results there. Some guys can get Mobley if they're quick, if they can get into his chest and knock him off balance a little bit. But yeah, both Mobley and Allen can really move their feet on the perimeter. I think Brunson's the kind of guy who can exploit that a little bit though, so I'm excited to see that.
Yeah, I thought the Mobley Brunson matchup was really fascinating to watch, because I actually thought Mobley did a good job moving his feet. And then, like, some of the shots, I mean, Brunson was just on one that night. I think he hit like a Dirk, for like one-legged Dirk fadeaway for Mobley. He had one where Mobley had.
I'm not going to say anything because I saw what happened last time. There we go. You good, Stace?
There we go.
Can you hear me?
Yes, now we can hear you.
Yeah, so he just created the smallest of windows, and like to create this little bunny, and it was excellent. So I think that I thought Mobley played good defense, and it often just didn't matter because Brunson was on one. Well, I think that is a little bit. I don't know if this was where Matt was going, but to me, that's a little bit of a fear because the last time the Knicks were here in the playoffs, we all felt really good about that team, and almost everyone turned into a pumpkin, right? And what happened to now? Brunson has done this in the playoffs, so I'm a little bit more confident that he would avoid some of the struggles that Randall had. But who knows if Randall isn't healthy and the defense can key in on Brunson? The Knicks have added some guys, but and they've still been an effective offensive team without Randall. That's definitely a concern. I'll also ask this. So one area the Knicks thrive on offense, they are so the way the Knicks like to play, you know, they ended up finishing second in the league in offensive rating. It's a pretty simple formula. I think it starts really with dribble penetration. So Brunson's the obvious one, but Brunson, IQ, RJ Barrett, and Randall can all attack the rim and draw bodies in the paint. This allows them to take a lot of corner threes. I think they were third in the league in corner three frequency. They get to the line a lot. And the last thing it does is this dribble penetration. I mean, they have like Mitchell Robinson and Isaiah Hartenstein are both excellent rebounders. Mitch, I think, might be the best offensive rebounder in the league. But a lot of that also is buoyed by the fact that Brunson draws so much attention. It's those Kobe assists, or even if it's a drive and kick to your point before, if the defense is scrambling, you know, that that can lead to offensive rebounding opportunities. And they added Josh Hart, who's been big on the glass. The question for me is like, on the one hand, the Cavs are the top defensive team in the league, or statistically they were, but they're also one of the worst defensive rebounding teams. So the two questions I'll ask is one, how much of that is a Jared Allen thing when he's not playing, they just look worse and he's missed time. So how much does the rebounding improve with him in? And the other thing is like, to what extent do the Cavs care? Because they're fine having Mobley roam and do all these things because clearly the defense, the results are there. So they're like, yeah, get as many rebounds as you want. But you're just not going to get good shots because of how we deploy Evan Mobley and move everybody around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there definitely is good data to back up the fact that the Cavs are a lot worse rebounding without Jared Allen on the floor. And so, yeah, lately they've struggled on the boards, but Jared's been hurt, so that plays a role into it. But at the same time, Allen's not going to be on the floor for all 48 minutes. And so, yeah, that's a legitimate question about what the Cavs are going to do in the non-Jarrett minutes. I mean, for how good Mobley is, he's not the best rebounder. He can definitely get bodied by Mitchell Robinson specifically, and Hardenstein could give him some trouble there.
Do you think the rebounding issues are more to Mobley not being strong enough maybe, or is it more that he's tasked with so many help response? I think helping and contesting and rebounding, like there's very few guys who are great at both, right? I think that's why people like Claxton so much. I think that's an area Mitchell Robinson is really good at. But do you think it's more Mobley, you know, poor rebounding rebounding fundamentals that are still developing, or is it more he's just tasked with so much, it's having to contest everything that it's impossible for him to really help out as much on the glass?
Yeah, I think that plays a big role. Yeah, he's the glue that makes Cleveland's defense work. He's flies all around the floor. He leads the league in, I think he's second in the league in contested shots behind Brook Lopez. Cleveland does a lot of rotating defensively. You got Mobley flying around to cover up something, then somebody else rotates in to fill in his spot. And the result of all that rotating is a lot of mismatches in the wake of it all. And so you might end up a position with Donovan Mitchell on Mitchell Robinson at the end of a shot. And most of the time that's an easy rebound for Mitch. Mitchell Robinson, I should specify, both and Mitchell. I think we'll see a lot of that. There will definitely need to be a team factor buying in for Cleveland just to help Jarrett and Mobley out on the boards down low, because The Cavs aren't going to change their game plan to put those two guys in more of a better position to rebound the ball.
One other thing I've seen from them, it seems like they've dabbled a little bit, at least in 4-5 pick and rolls with Mobley as the ball handler. Do you think we see a lot of that? Especially maybe if Randall's hurt or, how have they used that? And do you think that's something that they might make a pretty significant part of the game plan?
I wouldn't say you see a lot of it. There have been some reps of that in the regular season. I think a lot of that is, just trying to give Mobley his fair share of reps to develop his game for the future. I wouldn't say Mobley is a source of very efficient offense at this stage of his game. I think he'll be that will continue to grow in the future, and someday that will be the case. But as of now, I think we'll see the offense heavily revolve around Mitchell and Garland. We might see Mobley get the ball some in the high post just and have the guys move around him, maybe give him a couple face-up possessions. I wouldn't say that's a heavy part of their offensive game plan, though, in the playoffs.
Before I ask my next question, Braden, it's time for our mid-episode trivia question. I don't know if Stacey knows the answer to this. I figure you probably do, but I want to see if Braden knows it as well. There is one former Knick on your Cleveland Cavaliers roster. Do you know who that player is?
Let me think.
Stacey, without saying it, do you know who it is?
No.
Ooh, this is a good one.
Oh, I'm for
and this
forgetting.
This is a former Knick that has an underrated significance, I would say, to their recent history. Well, recent being 7 years ago.
It's not Robin Lopez, is
it? It is Robin
Lopez.
Oh,
that's right. Yeah.
It is Robin. So before I explain why Robin Lopez is oddly significant, just
I forgot he's on the Cavs.
With him ever with those two bigs? Does Robin Lopez ever play?
No, he's a deep depth piece.
I feel like they're saving him for the Bucks series, but
he's got unmatched vibes though. So
he's still one of my. He was here 1 year, and he's still one of my favorite Knicks. And
he was actually really good. I liked him a lot, and yes. I did not think they needed to upgrade to Noah. But go ahead.
That was
ended up not being an upgrade, obviously. That was but
Robin Lopez was where Phil Jackson first screwed up, because Lopez was great next to Porzingis, because Lopez would do the physical work and the banging and a lot of the rebounding. KP was great playing alongside him. Then Jackson traded Lopez for Derrick Rose the first run, which was not nearly as good as Derrick Rose the second run. And then Porzingis was stuck doing more of the work that really was best suited to Robin Lopez. My question is not about Robin Lopez, though. My question is about Evan Mobley's offense. What have you seen this season from Mobley? And if you have, where have you seen growth in his offensive game from a year ago?
Yeah, I'd say, from day one, I'd say the thing that stuck out to me is just how confident Mobley is. He's always been a quiet guy. And that was a legit concern with him going into the draft. There were a lot of people making a big deal of how quiet and soft-spoken he is and questioning if he really has a strong passion for the game of basketball.
Does he have that dog in him, right?
Yeah, that's definitely been proven false. I really appreciate how confident he is in his actions, how deliberate he is in his moves. Plays with a great sense of patience, lets things develop, and chooses the right time to attack. I'd say this season, the biggest area of growth we've seen is just him doing the little things as a big man, just rounding out that area of his game. We've seen him be much more confident as the sole big man on the floor when Jared Allen's not out there. He's improved tremendously as a screener, despite his slight frame, just getting all the positioning down and the timing of when to slip, when to hold your spot, and just getting all the short roll stuff down, being able to scan the floor, hit some floaters, take the extra dribble, throw in some hop steps, just really developing all the counters and stuff that you want to see as a rim-rolling big man and as a release valve down there.
Mm-hmm. Cleveland is a very different, I think, energy than New York City is, obviously, particularly toward their sports teams. But we all share the madness of NBA Twitter. So I'm curious, if the Knicks win this series, do you think Cleveland fans will consider the season? Like 2 years ago, the Knicks had a wonderful regular season. The playoffs were such a disappointment that I think it contaminated for a lot of people the good that had happened. Do you think the Cavs lose in 6 or 7 competitive games? Will the fan base feel more like, okay, this sucks, but we got a lot of stuff going for us, this is good? Or do you think it will really put kind of a damper on where they seem to be ascending toward?
Yeah, I think it's something that will obviously suck in the moment, but get over it relatively quickly. So yeah, I mean, I think there's some expected bumps in the road with it, and with the general lack of playoff experience for this team, especially with two of the key cogs, Garland and Mobley, with it being their first run. Yeah, I mean, as long as Donovan Mitchell shows that he can be his usual dynamic self and just show that we belong, I mean, we'll just ride along the expected improvements with Mobley. As Stacey hinted at it earlier, I think he's a future All-NBA lock, potential MVP candidate in the future. So if you can give him a year, a couple more years, I think that's when the Cavs really hit their contender level, once Mobley's playing at his highest level alongside Donovan Mitchell in the late stages of his prime. Yeah.
Is there a comp you have for Mobley? On the other pod I host with Schwinny Poo, I think early on he said there's Tim Duncan vibes there, especially with the post footwork, the footwork on defense, like just a lot of the things you're talking about in terms of the deliberate but like polish there. You know, is there a comp you have for him? Or
yeah, it's tough because I mean, yeah, he's such a unique player. I think the only ones you can really compare him to are like, you know, yeah, Tim Duncan, Kevin Garnett. There's a little bit of Anthony Davis there. I don't think any of those are perfect comps, but I think he's just his own guy to an extent. He's very talented in his own way.
I have a happy question for you and a not happy question for you. Which one do you want first?
Let's do not happy.
Okay. How low will you feel in 2 years if Donovan Mitchell signs with the Knicks?
Oof. Yeah, I don't like that question.
Okay, let me think of the happy one then instead. And because if the Knicks lose this series, we'll probably never talk to you again. If the Cavs win and they advance, how do they match up with Milwaukee this season? Because they seem to me like Milwaukee has great size. Cleveland has size. Milwaukee has a great defensive point guard in Holiday. He would be occupied, obviously, with Garland or potentially Mitchell. It seems to me from a distance like that's a matchup maybe even more than Boston and maybe Philadelphia. But I'm curious how the Cavs and Milwaukee match up in your eyes.
Yeah, I like that question better. Personally, I think Milwaukee is actually the best matchup for Cleveland out of those top three teams.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, between Mobley and Allen, you get those might be two of the best equipped players to throw at Giannis defensively. You got one of the benefits of picking up Donovan Mitchell was just giving another target for other teams to have to compensate for defensively, and that frees up Garland a good bit. Jrue Holiday is a guy who has just been able to completely shut down Garland's game, but in a series against Milwaukee, he'll probably be guarding Mitchell, and so that opens up a lot of opportunities for Darius. And so yeah, I wouldn't expect to win that series going into it, but I mean, probably in the same view that you guys have going into this series, I think we have a fighting chance.
Do you think if Randall is compromised to where he either misses a game or two, or he plays but he's 75%, would you still be concerned that the Knicks could win that series? Or do you feel like with the teams seemingly very evenly matched in a lot of ways that might be enough to guarantee like you're good?
Yeah, I think I think Randall is a big swing factor in it. I could see him giving the Cavs a lot of issues with how they defend, with how they're constructed. I think obviously if you have Obi Toppin next to Mitchell Robinson instead of Julius, the Cavs are a lot more comfortable helping off of Obi and just gives them a lot more freedom to do their thing defensively. So I think with Julius, the Knicks do have a solid shot to make things really tough for the Cavs.
Your language is very thoughtful. You didn't say with Julius. You said with Julius, I think they can make it tough. So I am guessing you feel very confident that Cleveland will win this series?
I'd say personally, I am more in that boat, yeah. I'm predicting a 4-2, 4-1 series probably, which maybe that's some of my bias showing, but...
No, I mean, I think most people, wherever you're leaning, I don't think anybody sees this as a sweep either way. And I think most people would bet it's going six games at least, no matter what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of Knicks fans are also saying Knicks in six, which I think is, I do think it could be just because some of my team loses Super Bowl, some of my team somehow lose to TCU. Saw the Knicks look awful against the Hawks. So I don't really feel like underestimated. And the truth is, like, advanced stats love this Cavs team. And the eye test likes the Cavs team. I think that there's areas that the Knicks can exploit. How much can the offensive rebounding and the ability for Brunson to attack the guards? That's key. If Brunson can get in the paint, get good looks, as well as open up offensive rebounding opportunities for Mitch, I think that's an area the Knicks have been very comfortable with. I think if they can really win bench units, that'd be interesting. I'm very fascinated to see with how Tibbs closes. And I will add this. I do think RJ Barrett is a very interesting X factor in this series. On the one hand, it feels weird to call a player making $100 million an X factor, but the reality is the Knicks are running a lot through Brunson and Randall. But what the Knicks have been really good at with RJ Barrett, or where he's really thrived, and they've done this especially against Miami when Tyler Hero is on the floor, is they will hunt out the smaller defender. So a lot of teams will hide a guy on someone like Grimes, right? Grimes is still not quite as dynamic off the dribble. So if they're going to hide Tyler Hero on Quentin Grimes, you screen with Grimes, who's been a good screener, and he has been a very good outlet as a role man, just because of the shooting, because he can put the ball on the floor. And I'd be very curious if they put Garland on Grimes, you know, if the Knicks try to attack that, because you can try to do that with Brunson, but you know, Okoro is probably going to be able to avoid switching. And you know, guys like Hart and Quickley are also very capable of attacking. But Barrett is especially good at that bully ball stuff that, and Garland seems pretty strong for his size, but that seems to be an area where the Knicks have thrived. So I definitely think that's a factor. And I'll ask you this, in terms of Mitchell and Garland, right? We've talked about their defense. Do you think one or either of them is better against like quicker guards or bigger guards? Like, for example, it looked to me like Donovan Mitchell was much more comfortable guarding RJ Barrett, because when Barrett would try to, you know, post him up or whatever, Mitchell was able to wall him off. He seems very strong. I don't know if it's a technique issue or what. On the other hand, like guarding Brunson, whether it's off of screens or it seems like he struggled more with that. So is it fair to say Garland is better at defending quick defenders and Mitchell is better at defending strong defenders, or are they just both inconsistent at both? Or
I think you got it right. Mitchell's a lot better at the guarding up onto the bigger defenders. Obviously just very strong. He's a tank and has that massive wingspan. I think he nowadays he relies a lot more on his athletic tools rather than the defensive fundamentals, so that probably limits him against the quicker guards, just not as focused on the defensive side of the ball in the NBA. Rightfully so, with how massive his offensive load is. So, yeah, I'd expect Mitchell to be matched up with Barrett. And then Yeah, Garland, I think the Cavs have had the most success using him as in like a kind of like a runner, just running around on the movement shooters, chasing them around screens. And yeah, I think we saw him a couple of weeks ago or a week ago or something when the Cavs played Atlanta. I think he did a pretty good job matched up with Trae Young, actually. Okoro was out of that game, and he ended up holding Trae to like 6 of 14 shooting or something like that. He's shown flashes of being able to hold his own, just a very small, weak defender. So yeah, there is trouble there, and teams have been able to exploit using him as the defender of the screener. So you're throwing Grimes in there as a screener for a quick pop or something like that. It'll be interesting to see if the Knicks can attack that.
To be fair to that last point, I mean, we all know Trae Young sucks, so that's not really that impressive. Kelsey Russo in The Athletic just had a good piece about interviewed some Knicks, some Pacers, and maybe some Pelicans about guarding Donovan Mitchell. And I had never known this. You just alluded to it, but one a kind of unanimous point everybody made about the challenge of guarding him is how strong he is. That he's really, really like a powerhouse at 6'1", 6'2", whatever he is. My last question for you is this, Brayden. New York fans are infamously, dispassionate about expressing opinions about their head coaches. I am wondering, in Cleveland, we haven't really talked about Bickerstaff, and I know you can't get 5 feet without Tom Thibodeau somehow being involved in whatever you're saying about the Knicks. What is the feel about Bickerstaff for Cavs fans at this point?
Yeah, I feel like, I feel like a typical trend with the NBA and probably all sports is that fans of teams are consistently disappointed with their coaches unless they're the very best in the game. I'd say that holds true to Bickerstaff to some extent. Just a lot
And
of
what are the praises or criticisms of Bickerstaff?
Yeah, the praises definitely would be defensively. He's got this Cavs team to compete. We've seen Kevin Love, Donovan Mitchell, Lauri Markkanen just buy in, play the best defense of their careers under him. And yeah, it's shown on the floor. He has a tremendous hold on the locker room. Just all the players really respect him and value what he has to say. I think offensively is where the questions come in. Yeah, I mean, as far as adjustments come, he doesn't have a lot of playoff experience. And fans of the Cavs like to nitpick his rotation decisions. Like, a common one is Lamar Stevens. There's a lot of guys who aren't the biggest fan of Lamar Stevens, but he's a hard worker. He's the coach,
Rebound.
yeah, rebounds, coach's son type of player. So, just the little things I think fans like to nitpick. Overall, I'm a big fan. I think he could be the one to go all the way with Cleveland through this next era. We'll see how that unfolds.
Nice.
So.
Cool.
Go ahead, Stacey.
Before we get out of here, so you mentioned before 4-1, 4-2. We do need an official prediction. Let's throw it to Braden first. Matt, I'm gonna need you to do one as well.
This will go on your permanent record too, just so you
All
know.
right. Yeah, I'd say 4-2, Cavs.
I say 4-3 Cavs.
Regardless of Randall's health there.
Yes.
That's interesting. I think 4-2 Cavs if Randall is hurt. And 4-3 Cavs if he's not. But if it goes to game seven, I like that we have Jalen Brunson. I'll say that. I worry about Donovan Mitchell, but I like that we have Jalen Brunson. So either way, I think it's going to be a really fun series. So
Oh
I
yeah,
should add,
that's gonna
I
be
have a
good.
prolific double jinx ability, so that may have influenced some of what I just said. Braden, one I do want to slip in one little bonus question, just because you just mentioned him here at the end now. I would have been terrified of the Cavalier bench if Kevin Love was still on the team, because of just what I know he can do, his experience, his everything. Are Cav fans cool with, like, okay, good, Kevin Love, enjoy your life in Miami? Is there any sense that they should have held on to him, or was it a mutual thing where, or he wanted out? Like, how did that all go?
Yeah, that was very unexpected.
So
if you look at the Cavs now, there's a little bit of a hole in the roster, and it's that 20 minutes or so at the backup four where only one of Mobley or Allen is on the floor, and you know, you can't play both of them 48 minutes. Got to get some guy to fill in that gap. And I think earlier on in the season, the Cavs were pretty content with having Dean Wade fill in those minutes with the two-way production that he was showing, just committing to a more youthful player long-term. We've seen him struggle with injuries and not being so consistent lately, so I think that's kind of made the optics of it not look so hot. It's interesting because Kevin Love, he really struggled this year in Cleveland. I mentioned that Bickerstaff has gotten him to just commit all in on defensively. And I don't think that's wavered much, but he just physically just can't do it anymore. Just can't really move. He's not that tall. He's 6'8", about. Doesn't close out to corner threes whatsoever. And then his shot was just falling off. And offensively, that's pretty much all the value he provides. Not the guy to take much shots inside the arc anymore. But, I mean, you look at rebounding also. He's obviously a good rebounder, and that's another area that the Cavs are missing him. So I think that will be interesting to look at this series, see how he does in Miami, and see if the Cavs miss him there.
Mm-hmm. Stacey, last bonus question for you. We know that 2 years ago when the Knicks last made the playoffs, they had a very, is there any possibility that in game three, 19,763 at Madison Square Garden will be chanting F Donovan Mitchell as he steps onto the floor?
I doubt that. Trey relished the villain role. Actually, there's
they had no choice in it, though. Like, Trey literally showed up and everybody's cursing him out.
For most of his career, I think he has, though. I think it was exaggerated against the Knicks. Draymond Green actually was on the podcast with Taylor Rooks. It's actually a really good podcast, and he was talking about, she asked him, like, you know, do you enjoy being the villain? And he's like, honestly, no. Like, it has its moments, right, when you get to shut people up. But, like, you know, like, people want to be liked, right? It's like, you know, it's all, like, so. And he said, you know, like, he specifically mentioned Trae Young. And he's like, I get what he's doing. But I would tell him, like, after a while, like, it takes a toll if you're just hated. I will say, I think Trae Young and his dad kind of, like, his dad is pretty classy on Twitter. I think they handled it well. But I think it's also, I don't think Donovan Mitchell, one, I don't think he would ever really want to be the villain in the same way in New York. Like, he would want to be the guy that rips out Madison Square Garden's hearts, but he's not a Reggie Miller type of guy. It'd be more like, it'd be like more like the way Kobe came back, and like, he always talked about how he loved playing at the Garden, but it wasn't to be a villain. I think if Donovan Mitchell, even by the standards of, I'm here.
Yeah, we got you.
Donovan Mitchell, even by the standards of normal NBA players, is a pretty classy, right? Yeah. He's well-liked. You know, dad worked with the Mets for a long time, so he understands, you know, polished image and all of that. That's why it's so shocking to see the things that happened with Dylan Brooks. Just because we're knee-jerk sympathetic to Mitchell, just because, A, Brooks is a reputation, Mitchell has a reputation. Got to that point where he's just dominating, I think he would get respectful cheer. Well, he would get the Knicks fans know when to acknowledge true greatness. He also doesn't foul bait really as much as Trey, so that's another thing like that annoys a lot of fans, just knee jerk, which Brunson and Quickley are not innocent in this regard, so it's fair for opposing fans to mention that. But I don't think the Knicks are the only fan base that gets annoyed at Trae Young. And then the last thing I'll mention is worse than the boos, worse than Knicks fans chanting fuck Donovan Mitchell in game three, is that if he does just dominate this series and the Knicks lose, we're going to have to hear for a long time, oh, they didn't trade for Donovan Mitchell. It's a referendum, which, like, right. It's very stupid, right? The whole idea, like, they would not have added Donovan Mitchell to this roster. You're probably losing Grimes and Quickley and a bunch of picks. Those have been both pretty important players. There's a good chance they don't have the assets to trade for Hart. So you have Mitchell, Randall, Brunson, RJ, and Mitch. That still would have been a good team. Do I think that would have been the Cavs probably wouldn't have been this good. So in that sense, yeah, maybe the Knicks would have been like a four seed. But I don't think that was a title contender either, and the Knicks wouldn't have had flexibility. So I think making this series a referendum on the Donovan Mitchell trade is unfortunate. Well, at least on our end. I think it's a smashing success for Cleveland no matter what. But it, like we discussed before, it's a different situation when you have Mobley and Garland, both on rookie deals at the time. I know Garland's been extended, but you have those guys, you have picks, you have the ability to take that shot, which the Knicks didn't at this point. But like it or not, I think we are going to hear that from certain members of the national media, and that this proves that the Knicks should have traded for Mitchell and the whole season's a failure, blah, blah, blah. But I think Brunson's going to come out and put up a fight too. So I think that people who watch the series will realize that. So.
Well, while Knicks and Cavalier fans will have different rooting interests over the next couple of weeks, we can at least all bond over already being tired of whatever Stephen A. Smith will have to say about Donovan Mitchell and the Knicks. Braden Todd, I want to thank you very much for joining us on this episode. Please, audience, remember you can follow Braden on Twitter at Bray_NBA. And there is a Substack coming out too. So if you follow the Twitter, I'm sure you will also receive the Substack info, unless Elon Musk keeps being a dick and does things with Substack that won't work. But we'll talk about that next episode. Braden, good luck to you and to your team as long as they don't win. Very nice to have you on the pod, and we will look forward to seeing you again in the future.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, guys. Yeah. I enjoyed it.
Cool. Remember, this is the Believe Knicks podcast. It's always presented by Bet Online. It is also presented by me and Stacy, who do all the work. Thank you, everybody. Have yourselves a wonderful Tuesday, and we will probably talk to you by the weekend. Peace, everybody.